Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we are heading toward the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote in the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Very timely, with women demanding more equality right now as a front and center issue. In its time, the women's suffrage movement exposed some fault lines and ignited culture war battles that continue to reverberate today. So let's look back and see how we're still living that history with Elaine Weiss, journalist and the author now of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Elaine, welcome to WNYC. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Why a book on the women's suffrage movement now?
Well, I think it's a part of our history that's just been ignored for a long time. There's a lot of scholarly writing about it, but not in the popular realm. I think I wanted to write a popular book, a popular history that's well-researched and referenced, but also tells a story. And it's a very important part of our history. It's the enfranchisement of half of the nation. And it's a struggle that reverberates not only through the rest of the 19th and 20th century, but also today.
Your book includes many people, both men and women, and their contributions to obtaining the right to vote for women. But you begin with three women whose names are not household names: Carrie Catt, Sue White, and Josephine Pearson, who are speeding to Nashville in an attempt to influence the vote there. Of course, a vote for a constitutional amendment has to go state by state. So you want to recover those names, reclaim them from the dustbin of history, and give them a little more publicity?
Sure. I think that's part of the joy of learning about the movement. It was not just the four mothers that we usually hear about: Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott. They're very important. But the movement went on for three generations, and women had to learn, had to be groomed in leadership, which is, I think, an interesting lesson for today. And then they had to take over the reins because the fight went on for 72 years. So it was a real thrill to learn that these three women arrive in Nashville for the last battle of the women's suffrage struggle.
Because Tennessee was the last state to ratify, to put it
correct,
over the top.
Correct. And they weren't sure it would. And so reading the Tennessee newspapers, the historic newspapers, I found that these three women actually arrive at Nashville Union Station on the same night. They represent different sides of the issue and different strands of the suffrage movement. So Carrie Chapman Catt is the president of the largest suffrage organization in the country, the National American Association. She's also the leader of the international suffrage movement. And that's a good reminder for us that it wasn't just happening in America. It had already been achieved in Great Britain, and it was around the world.
One of the great things about this book is the many images that you include. And one that stood out was a broadside poster titled "America When Feminized," which sounds right out of Breitbart. And it depicts a hen leaving her eggs behind and telling the rooster to sit on the eggs himself. And one line on the broadside reads, "A vote for federal suffrage is a vote for organized female nagging forever." My goodness. And the thing is, you're right that this ad was made by anti-suffragists, that is, women. What was the role of women in the anti-suffragist movement, what you refer to in the book throughout as the antis?
Yes, it's really fascinating. It was quite shocking to me to realize that a substantial portion of the opposition to women's suffrage, and specifically the 19th Amendment, were women themselves. And they took different approaches to their opposition. There were women like the muckraking journalist Ida Tarbell was actually against women's suffrage. The founder of Barnard College was. Eleanor Roosevelt was not actually a suffragist at all.
Really?
She did not support it. She did not join the movement.
Why in her case?
I think it was her milieu that she grew up in. It was wealthy. The women in her world had their own soft political power. They could persuade their men. She's also a very insecure mother of five children at the point. And she doesn't know what her role should be as the wife of a candidate. Her husband, FDR, is running for the vice presidency. But to go back to the antis, the other part of their opposition that we see so clearly in Tennessee is these women are social and political and cultural conservatives. And they believe that women demanding the vote and entering the political world in any way will destroy the family. As you said, that incredible broadside that they publish showing the woman abandoning her family, abandoning the nest to go out to vote. And they really feel, they say this very explicitly, it's going to mean the moral collapse of the nation. And we see echoes of that today in certain social cultural issues. It's really the first salvo in what we call the culture wars.
And if that was supposed to be an effective argument against woman suffrage, that, you know, they tell the rooster to go sit on the eggs himself, then I guess with the women's suffrage movement, the push to get women the right to vote, there was not any kind of parallel movement at that point to get women equality in the workplace and have men do more of the domestic work and sit on the eggs, well, after the eggs hatched, themselves?
There's a lot of anti-suffrage drawings, cartoons, and broadsides that use that theme of if women go out to vote, be ready, husbands. You're going to have to watch the children. There's great cartoons. It's election day, and the woman is marching out the door, and the husband is holding squalling babies. And it really says, beware, this is what's going to happen to you. So yeah, there's a real fear that men are going to have to share the domestic duties. And there's also the fear that if women demand the vote, what else are they going to demand? They're going to demand to go out to work outside the home. And that's a big fear at the time.
My guest is Elaine Weiss, whose new book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Listeners, any questions about that piece of our history, those last years really leading up to the 1920
yes.
Final ratification of the 19th Amendment, 212-433-WNYC, or how it relates to today, 212-433-9692. Many of the antis were also against the idea of having black women in particular vote. Who made that case? Did they make it explicitly? Was it not just seen as overtly racist? Obviously, it was hard. It was not that long after slavery. Jim Crow was in full swing. Why did that get attached to it?
Race is always an issue in the women's suffrage movement. It's born out of the abolition movement. And so the women we consider the foremothers, Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, they're all abolitionists first. That's how they cut their teeth politically. When it comes to the South, especially, it is totally blatant. There's no pulling any punches. We do not want black women voting. Black men who legally have the vote have been essentially disenfranchised by Jim Crow intimidation, lynchings, onerous restrictions on their literacy tests and poll taxes. So they can't vote at all.
And you reveal that there were some white suffragists who were willing to barter away black women's right to vote if it secures white women's rights.
Yes. It's pretty clear that quite a few white suffragists were willing to say, look, in the South, if you enfranchise women, there are more white women than black women, and so it will not endanger white supremacy. And white supremacy is on the line, according to the anti-suffragists in the South, and states' rights. The states' rights argument is very, very strong in this last ratification campaign in the South. And, of course, that same states' rights argument is going to, we're going to hear it again in the civil rights era in the 50s and 60s. We still hear it now.
And I don't know if anybody used the word intersectionality back then, but we have, for example, Ida B. Wells, who yeah. is involved in that last stand for women getting the right to vote in the 1920s. And you write about how her work as a suffragist intersected with her work for civil rights.
Yes, she is quite a heroine. She's brave. She's fearless in her journalism and in her personal life. And there's this famous photograph of her being told in the 1913 Great Women's Suffrage procession in Washington to go to the back of the march where the black suffragists, and there are many, many black women who are suffragists and are active in organizing. And she is told to go to the back of the line, and she says, no, I will not. I'm going to march with my Illinois suffrage compatriots. And there's a photograph in the book of her marching in defiance and marching with them. Black women were often given the back seat in the movement, but they were very active in organizing in their churches, in their clubs. And in some places, they worked in a fair amount of harmony with the white suffragists. It depended on the local conditions.
You know, the New York Times is doing that series now of obituaries of 15 remarkable women who were overlooked in the history of the Times, which they acknowledge was primarily a history on the obit page of white men. And Ida B. Wells is one of those 15.
Absolutely. And I was very amused by that because the New York Times is one of the most vociferous opponents of women's suffrage.
At the time?
At the time, in the 19th and early 20th century, the Oaks family also owns the Chattanooga Times in Tennessee. And so they're very involved in covering this event. And it's very interesting to read their anti-suffrage editorials. So we see the two New York Times publications, the Times publications really fighting against this.
Linda in Bloomfield, you're on WNYC with Elaine Weiss. Hi, Linda.
Hi there. So I actually have a question. I wanted to know whether there were men substantially involved in the suffrage movement, and if there were, what did their participation mean for them? Like how were they treated by their peers? Were they welcomed by the women? What was that like?
Thank you, Linda. That's a great question. And yes, they were very involved at all levels, in Congress, in the cities, in the states. There were always men who were champions of women's suffrage, and they were embraced. There's actually a new book out called Suffragettes that talks just about the men's cooperation with the movement. And they had to be brave because they were made fun of. And they were ostracized in their clubs, and they were called pansies and Nancys. And, how could a real man support this kind of thing? And would you allow your wife to do this? So they have to take quite a bit of guff to stand up for justice.
And the sad irony, of course, is that by definition, it's only men who are able to decide whether women are granted the right to vote.
Absolutely.
In effect, full citizenship. And I guess, as you point out, in a very real way, it was asking men to dilute their political power.
Yes. When we think of it in just brute terms, we're asking men to dilute their political power by half. And that's a big ask.
David in New Rochelle, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, yes, thanks. 100 years ago, as we were just saying, these women in the suffrage movement, even in the prohibition movement, were very fierce. And then, flash forward 100 years later, when Trump said that stuff on the infamous bus incident, a number of reporters like Judy Woodruff went out and spoke to white women throughout the country, some moderates, some swing voters, some Republican. And surprisingly to me, their reaction was very defending it. They thought, I remember one woman said that she thought it was funny, or that's just how men spoke. So I guess I was very surprised at that. And I was wondering, what does that say about, do we take our rights for granted today? Because whether we look at Homeland Security or other issues, our rights can be taken away. And I was wondering why a lot of white women in middle America thought that was perfectly fine.
Right. And of course, we've talked so much on this show about the fact that a majority of white women voted for Donald Trump, even as close to the release of the Access Hollywood tape as, you know, 1 month later was Election Day. A majority of white women in Alabama voted for Roy Moore, despite what came out about him. And so race turns out to be a bigger divide in this country than gender when it comes to voting patterns. But Elaine, how do you see the line from the history that you were writing about that really ended in 1920 when the 19th Amendment was passed to what's going on right now in this respect?
Well, I finished the manuscript the day before the November 2016 election, so I was not anticipating exactly what has happened. But in fact, in the months...
Can I just stop and linger on that for a second? In other words, this book was going to be part of the celebration, in a certain respect, of how far women have come, because Hillary Clinton was supposed to win the election.
Yes, that was in the back of my mind. But that I wrote it to be a fascinating history that has resonance today. I did not realize how much resonance it was going to have, and that it brings up,
maybe more so,
as our listener has suggested, it brings up the idea of today when rights are being endangered in a way that we never expected it to be. And that includes not just women's rights, but voting rights and press freedoms and core values of our democracy. I think looking to the story of the suffragists and how they went about organizing and sustaining this political and activist movement, these were just grassroots activists.
Did you go back and make any edits after the election turned out the way it did the day after you handed in the manuscript?
No, I didn't. But it was clear that those elements popped through on their own, and I think readers will find them there. And the afterword I write about what happens in 1920 and right after 1920, I think, again, has far more resonance now than it might have if the election had turned out differently.
I'll note from your book, because I think people will find it interesting, that there was a lot of corporate opposition to women's suffrage. Mills were afraid that women might want to abolish child labor. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. And the liquor industry is afraid that women might want to enforce the new prohibition laws that were new at that time.
Correct. So we're seeing what we would call today dark money in these campaigns. These corporations are coming in and financing anti-suffrage activities very secretly. It's hard to trace the money, but it's quite clear. And the liquor industry especially is very nervous at this moment.
What was support for prohibition a motivating factor in women's suffrage at all?
The two movements were very much aligned in the 19th century, and many suffragists are temperance workers. But it's not for just the moral reason. It actually is a sense of public health and domestic tranquility, because a lot of women who cannot own their own property or even their own wages, their husbands are drunk, they get beaten up, they have no recourse, they cannot press suit in a court of law, they have no standing. So to have some laws that will make it harder for their husbands to be drunk and to spend the family money on drink rather than bread is really an important, it's a feminist issue. It's not just a moral issue.
We have 1 minute left. Earlier in the show, we covered the students' national walkout for gun control measures, which took place last hour. What sort of precedent do you think the women's suffrage movement set for political activism today, and is there a lesson in there for the students and the March for Our Lives movement?
Oh, I think there definitely is, and it's incredible for me to see this happening right now. The women who participated in the suffrage movement were just ordinary mothers, housewives, teachers, students, Sunday school teachers, and they go out, they see something is wrong, and they take to the streets, they petition, but they don't just, they pick up the White House, they don't just do that. They also marry those protests with sustained and coordinated political action. And I think that's the lesson for today.
A lot to be learned from the history in this book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Author Elaine Weiss has been our guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. A real pleasure.